You got to take a listen to this. It's Squawk Pod.
That's right. CNBC's flagship business news show is a podcast, Squawk Pod.
This is CNBC Control 2.
It is not just the show, folks.
It might be even better because it's only audio.
Join me, Katie Kramer, as I take you inside the Squawk Box control room and beyond the headlines of our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday.
Roll alpha.
Listen to CNBC's Squawk Pod free on the Odyssey app.
It is a delightful 52 degrees outside right now, going up to only 70. Highs of 74 tomorrow, 77 Saturday, 78 on Sunday, 79 on Monday. Nothing but sunshine, not quite sweater weather, but still beautiful. We're getting ready to talk about the presidential race, the presidential election. I would like for you to text me at 504-260-1870. Give me your predictions. How do you think this thing turns out? And with that, we welcome in Dr. Robert Hogan, professor and department chair of political science at LSU. How are you, Dr. Hogan?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about this presidential race. I know Kamala Harris did an interview on Fox News yesterday, and I got some texts from people that were looking at social media. And, you know, I got it immediately reminded me of the spin room after a debate, right, where everybody goes on social media to spin the appearance or the debate of either candidate. It's not just with Kamala Harris on Fox. It could be Donald Trump on whatever, where they spin it to make it seem as though they're messing this up or they're doing this great or they're doing that or the other thing. Talk, if you will, about, how pervasive that is with people trying to spin stuff on social media. And a lot of this comes from the candidates or PACs themselves, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is the new, mechanism for trying to spin things. You used to have, the spin room after debates and things, but now you have, you still have a lot of opinion makers. They don't write articles in the New York Times. Well, they still do, but those are less opinion, influencers as people on social media. So you certainly have a lot more of that than you used to. And you see this after every campaign appearance or debate or whatever it happens to be. There are people who have a stake in the outcome, and they're trying to get people to focus on certain aspects of a performance or a debate and de-emphasize aspects of it where their candidate or their preferred candidate didn't do as well as they thought they would.
How do people know when they see the results of a poll and who's leading what where, whether the poll is accurate, whether the poll is sponsored, whether for whatever reason? I've heard everything from, one side is trying to make it seem as though the other doesn't have a chance to suppress voter turnout. One side's trying to make it seem as though the other doesn't have a, or the one side is trying to make it seem as though they don't have a chance to get people to go out and vote as opposed to suppress. Other people are saying, well, these polls are being done to set up to make it show that one side or the other is the clear winner so that after the election can be contested. Your thoughts as the department chair of political science at LSU about polling and all of that?
Well, I mean, the only thing I can say is that, you still have a lot of polls that are intended to obtain a more positive result for their preferred candidate. And in the past, what you've had is you've had major news organizations looking at the different polls that are made publicly available, and they have experts that recognize, well, some of these polls are from a reputable firm, right? And they dig into how they've done the polling, the mechanics behind it, the weighting that they use, and they would usually only report those kinds of polls. Today, again, as you mentioned earlier, on social media, you just have this flood of information. How do you make sense of it? I mean, in recent years, news organizations, as well as social scientists, have attempted to aggregate some of these things. And so that's what you see a lot of these news organizations doing, 538 and other ones in the media. What they do is they don't just base their, don't just emphasize one poll, but they say, look, we're going to look at the moving average of all the polls, over whatever time period, the last week, the last 6 months. And by aggregating them, the idea is that you get a better view of actually what's going on. So you don't, any one poll doesn't weigh too much. However, in these aggregation mechanisms, they do weight the polls, right? Some polls have a larger sample size. Some have, or, you know, they also base them on their reputation of being correct about the outcome, those sorts of things. And so hopefully with this aggregation, you have a better perspective than you used to have when it was all based on one poll. So I guess I'm trying to say, in this modern age where you have lots and lots of different polls talked about on social media, you also have this aggregation of polls that I think gives a better perspective. Now, having said that, some people believe that the aggregation of the polls is being gamed by some political operatives. In other words, what they do is they say, okay, you're aggregating the polls. Well, we'll just do more polls that are biased in favor of our candidate. And you include that in your aggregation. And that's the way we have an influence on how the polls look. So, you know, we have a different perspective now on the utility of polls for assessing the state of the race. And then you have gamemanship trying to, find strategic ways of influencing, that perspective.
It seems like sometimes the candidates jump sides where they say, well, the polls are accurate if they win, but then the polls are inaccurate if they lose. And it can't be both ways, right?
Right. I mean, if you're ahead, candidates' internal polling based upon the assumptions that they have about the electorate and those sorts of things, if they believe that they're ahead and it matches the public polls, they're going to say, look at the polls. I'm ahead. Of course, they don't want to do that too much, because if they give the people they're trying to attract a false sense of security, many of them won't vote. So in some ways, no matter if you're far ahead or just a little bit ahead, or if you're behind, you want to make people feel that their vote counts and they need to turn out and vote.
When it comes to 538 or one of the reputable polling average places, what are they showing?
I think generally the aggregations show that Kamala Harris is, about 2 points ahead nationally. They try to do this aggregation at the state level as well, although it's more difficult because the state polls have smaller sample sizes. And there is where you see an enormous amount of volatility. Whereas we've seen some trends. I mean, since Harris entered the race, she did seem to have a bit of a bump. And that was made even higher, I think, by the convention and also by the debate. But her support level has sort of plateaued and has not continued to rise. And so we have a situation where you look at the state polls and you find sometimes she's ahead, sometimes he's ahead, depending on which poll comes out. The way I view this is that the race is extraordinarily tight at the national level. It's extraordinarily tight in these seven battleground states. And what really matters in these situations is the turnout game. It's who can get their voters to the polls. And I think that is reflected in what the candidates are doing and what they're saying. It seems to me that they are very much attempting to mobilize their base of support by their actions, and it is about turning people out. Keep in mind that people are turning out now. Voting is occurring, and by Election Day, they estimate as many as half of the voters will have voted even before Election Day activities get underway. So votes are being banked at this point. I mean, in these competitive battleground states, if the organizations are doing their job really well, they will know soon who has voted. They won't waste any more time trying to mobilize them, and they can funnel that money into those towards those voters who haven't yet voted. So this is the high point, or the most busy time for these campaigns as they try to work through this, especially in these battleground states. And the question is, with the battleground states this year, is the Democrats are using their traditional campaign organizations, campaign techniques and tactics that they've used. Republicans are doing something very different. The Trump campaign has turned over the operations to a third party, an outside group, the Turning Point USA people. and is hoping that that will be as effective as traditional Republican Party organizations are at turning out the vote. There are a lot of Republicans that are very skeptical and worried about this, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Let me take a break. We come back. I get texts from people talking about a landslide one way or the other, an electoral landslide one way or the other. We'll talk about that when we return, some other things as well. Dr. Robert Hogan, our guest, professor, department chair of political science at LSU, talking about the presidential race, and people text me all the time about this one said that and that one said that. And to me, it's kind of like the Fox or pregame show or CBS pregame show. It doesn't matter who predicts who to win what. It all depends what happens when you play the game, or in this case, when the election happens. 623 traffic now, WWL. All right, 627, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Dr. Robert Hogan, professor, department chair of political science at LSU, talking about the presidential election. Voting is already underway, begins here in Louisiana tomorrow. Dr. Hogan, you know, I get texts occasionally from people opining that there could be a landslide one way or the other in the Electoral College, or I guess popular vote, not that that really matters. Thoughts on that?
No, absolutely. Anytime that there is a close election like this in the past, you look, oftentimes, you know, it breaks, you know, for one candidate, you know, it breaks one way. For whatever reason, voters are influenced or affected by some set of conditions or something. And so they break in one direction, and it ends up being an electoral landslide. I mean, this has happened in recent years, and I suspect we're set up right now because it is so competitive in each of the seven battleground states. You're going to see something very similar this time. It's going to go mostly in one direction or the other.
People text in also worried about, you know, peaceful transfer of power and so forth.
Yeah,
it's a lot different when whoever is contesting the election is not in power, correct? Constitutionally and so forth?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the counting of the electoral votes will be done by Kamala Harris in the joint session of Congress this time. I think the situation, given its competitive nature, is ripe for contestation. I mean, reports have indicated that the Trump campaign is already preparing to contest states if they lose them. And, you know, what that involves, you know, we don't know. We know what happened on January 6th. Last night, I think Trump said it was a day of love, last time. I don't know if that's how most people would describe what happened in 2021. But I think that, you know, the competitive nature of this, it is ripe for contestation. And, you know, I think there is a potential for violence, just given what polls show us.
But I'm going to run a little bit late here just because I want to get this question in. I remember seeing a picture of John McCain the day after he lost the election, just pulling out, going to get a cup of coffee, where suddenly he becomes irrelevant. When it comes to something like this, the losing candidate, if they're not the incumbent, has a lot less power than does a sitting president.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, if Trump loses, the key question is, does the whole Trump movement, what happens to it? Does it stall? Does the Republican Party reinvent itself?
All right. Thank you, Dr. Hogan. Appreciate your time. As always, we'll take a break. Come back with Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, here on WWL. No frost on a pumpkin, but it's 52 degrees, and it feels pretty, pretty nice, going up to only 70 today, 74 tomorrow, 77 Saturday, 78 Sunday. So it warms a little, but it stays fall-esque. And with that, we welcome in Mike Strain, our good friend, Dr. Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. How are you, Mike?
Man, I am great. You're right, man. It feels good outside, doesn't it?
It feels great. The big question I have for you, and I'm going to get right to it, is how is Hootie?
Hootie is doing great. Hootie is on the floor here, barking and playing and running up here and playing with toys. Hootie is doing absolutely well. This dog hit the golden lottery ticket, so I'm having a great time.
We should all have Hootie's life, huh, Doc?
Oh, what? Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And Hootie's going to have a great day today, like every day. Hootie goes to work with my wife every day, goes to the clinic, to the veterinary hospital, and just has a glorious time every day playing with the staff and everybody there, and he gets to come back to the farm in the evenings and play and on the weekends and having just a a grand old time for Hootie.
Hootie is the newest member of the Strain family, a basset hound, right?
Little female basset hound, right now. About 10 weeks old now.
And what color? Yes.
So black and white and brown.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And
yep,
when,
yep.
And, when do they start howling? Or what do they do? Is that what they do?
Hootie's just starting to howl right now. You missed her about 2 minutes ago. She was howling at her squeaky toys here.
Well, you know what? We're dog friendly, Doc, so let her howl if she wants to. Let her howl away.
Let her howl. Oh, yeah, if she doesn't have the exorbitant amount of attention, she'll howl a little bit to you better than she's okay. Then it's nap time.
Well, ignore her a little bit to see if we can get her hear her howl. Talk about the farm bill. What's going on with that?
Well, the farm bill is just static. Nothing is happening. And the farm bill actually expired on the end of September. And a number of programs just stop. And I'll give you, for instance, they cannot hire people in the USDA for the Farm Services Agency or the NRCS. They can't hire them because they don't have authorization under the Farm Bill. Many of the programs, once the current contracts have been completed, they can't sign up more contracts. And that's on conservation and all the many different programs. So the disaster provisions are still in play because they are a continuum, and so is the nutrition provisions. But everything else basically has ceased to move forward. And the Farm Bill is the roadmap to the greatest industry in Louisiana and in America. So you think about funding for research, funding to expand markets overseas, all the different conservation programs that go on, all the different support programs, all of that stops. And, you know, we kept getting promised, oh, don't worry, you'll have it by November. That was last November. Now, don't worry, you'll have it by November, this November. Now, they say, well, don't worry, the next Congress will take it up. They need to come in and vote on this. The Farm Bill is less than 1% of the national budget, less than 1%. And the commodity section is less than 15% of the Farm Bill. And it's sitting out there in limbo because, remember, the nutrition program continues, which is 85% of the Farm Bill. And so they need to come back in the lame duck session and vote the Farm Bill out. This is ridiculous, you know, and our patience is really just worn thin. Enough, go get your job done and go to work.
Can
you imagine if we went to Baton Rouge and didn't pass any bills?
Yeah, who is it that's not doing this? Doc, are they busy campaigning or what's going on?
Well, they're out for the campaign break, but they've had 2 years. Mm. They've had this thing to vote on for a year. You know, so as they say, nothing really has been happening in Washington in the halls of Congress, and they need to bring it up to a floor vote. They need to vote it and move it out. They can't just say, oh, we'll do it later and keep kicking a can down the road on this and many other issues. They need to vote. We need a farm bill, and we want it now.
Doc, I'm looking at a picture of Hootie that Tim found on your Facebook page. This dog's got some ears on it, huh?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yes. Yeah, it was so funny. It was trying to lick its side. Hootie's trying to lick her side the other and couldn't because her ears kept getting in the way.
That is a beautiful dog. That dog makes my ears look small. No kidding. That's how big hers are. Let's talk about yesterday being National Real Sugar Day, and how about the sugarcane harvest? How's that going? I know it had been, which was kind of, we learned some every time we talked to you, but that, I get the storms confused. Francine knocked it down, but then the sun raises it up,
down,
right?
But yeah, so the sunshine came out, and, you know, and I've talked to my friend, the Senator Alonso, how you doing, you know, in that particular area, and I'll be there in St. Mary Parish next week. But with the sunshine and the good weather, the cane is leaning back up that was knocked down from the hurricane. In other words, the hurricane pushes it down. Cane is an amazing product. And so it takes a little bit of sugar, a little energy to lift back up, but the harvest is going well. We have about 530,000 plus acres of sugarcane, 530,000. And it'll be about $1.4 billion, and that's at the farm gate. And overall, you know, some of these farms produce over 8,000 pounds of raw sugar per acre. We've got all the plant cane in the ground. So, in other words, we first start cutting cane in September, and that's what's called plant cane because that's the cane that is harvested the first year cut and then replanted. Cane's in the ground 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so then we start, now we are harvesting for sugar, and that's on the 2, 3, and 4 year stubble. And that is going very well. The other exciting thing is that with the new varieties by LSU, We've got cane in the ground that doesn't lose production in years 2, 3, and 4. Some of the older cane, each year you had less sugar in the cane, but these new varieties are just like super cane, and it's really good. So the weather is dry right now, and it's a little too dry for a number of things. We'll talk about that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But that makes the cane harvest is going well. Sugar is running well. Sugar prices are running around, you know, 37, and so that's okay. 37, 38, 38 and a quarter. That's 38.25 cents per pound for raw sugar. And so, you know, we're doing okay on sugar. We hope we're going to have a good season. And hopefully we'll be done by the early part or mid part of January in harvest. So, again, when you see those cane trucks every day, those farmers have to make a quota. They're assigned a quota at the mill. So every day they have to make that quota, rain or shine, because once we fire those mills up, the mills run on the sugar cane. In other words, the fiber, the bagasse, is what runs the mill. We burn that in boilers that generate electricity and steam, and that's what run the mills. So once we fire it up generally on natural gas, and then it runs on its own power until we shut it down. It runs round the clock, 7 days a week, until we close the mill at the end of harvest. So we're excited about this year's sugar harvest.
Something else I didn't know what you taught us. 6:52, let me take a quick break. We'll be back with Dr. Mike Strain when we return. Maybe Hootie will howl for us when we come back. He's the commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Hootie, a beautiful little basset hound puppy. 6:52, 8 till 8 now. Traffic, WWL. 6:57, that's how anxious I am to get back to Mike Strain, because he always teaches us stuff like sugarcane plants powering themselves with the bagasse that comes off of the sugarcane. Mike, let's talk about dry conditions, burn bans, etc.
Yes, we're in a red flag warning, which means conditions are such that you can get a bad burn. We've got a lot of the state that is abnormally dry, and so we've issued the red flag warning. We have burn bans now more than 15 parishes. And what it means that with as dry as it is and the low humidity and the winds that are picking up, we're starting to see fires. And most of these fires are brush piles that people have lit and walk away from. So please, right now is not a good idea to burn anything. I know it's beautiful outside, but please, the conditions, we don't want major fires. Day before yesterday, we had 9 fires. We had a number of fires yesterday. And as we go into the weekend, we don't want this to end up to be a major fire weekend for us, because, again, we're asking everybody, please observe those burn bans. And the burn bans work. They really do. They make a huge difference. But right now it's dry out there. It's very, very dry. And, of course, you know, that brush pile can get away. One of the biggest problems we have is that people will light a brush pile and then leave it. Mm-hmm. You can't leave it attended until it's completely out, O-U-T. Completely out, because if you don't, it will get away from you.
And if you want to get a pumpkin, get a Louisiana pumpkin or not, can you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you know, they should be getting ready. You know, that we're a little late on our pumpkins this year, but look for that certified Louisiana. Go to a pumpkin patch. Look, let's have some fun. It's time. You know, Halloween is right here. Let's have certified Louisiana. Don't forget, you got to have those Louisiana pecans. Mm-hmm. You don't want those. Oh, they are absolutely the best. And when you make that pecan pie, you want some good old Steen's cane syrup. So buy fresh, local, and certified Louisiana products.
Thank you, Mike Strain. A pleasure as always. Scratch Hootie behind those ears for me, would you? There you go. You're just trying to get it a howl. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it as always. We'll take a break. We come back. We can talk to Mark Hamrick, senior bank rate economic analyst, about Americans and inflation here on WWL.
You got to take a listen to this. It's Squawk Pod.
That's right. CNBC's flagship business news show is a podcast, Squawk Pod.
This is CNBC Control 2.
It is not just the show, folks.
It might be even better because it's only audio.
Join me, Katie Kramer, as I take you inside the Squawk Box control room and beyond the headlines of our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday.
Roll alpha.
Listen to CNBC's Squawk Pod free on the Odyssey app.
We are talking about inflation now with Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst. 41% of Americans say inflation is their biggest economic issue. How you doing, Mark?
Doing well. Good to be with you, Tommy. Hope you are also.
I am fantastic. Mark, let me ask you this. You know, so many times we see elections and people thinking that the Democrats are going to help them or the Republicans are going to help them, and they blame this one or they blame that one. But you know what? When it comes to financial responsibility, how dependent are the people on what happens? I don't know if there's ever been a study of this on what the government does, what the stock market's doing, or people's own personal behavior. Because I don't care who's in power or what Congress we have or where the balance of power stands. If I'm spending more than I take in, I'm going to have a problem, yeah. Right?
There's a lot packed in that, so let me
take your
time,
Mark. Take your time. You got a half an hour. Go slow.
We'll be here all week, everybody. We'll have a brunch buffet coming up,
and then Mark will be at Haha's. By the way, I wanted to mention his appearance. Haha's in Virginia on Tuesday, and then next Thursday, I think you'll be at Chuckles Laugh Academy. Right
there, you go. Right. Yes, and then the pet hotel after that.
Exactly.
But at any rate, obviously a bank rate, our bread and butter is dialing into how Americans are doing with their personal finances. And there is no question, I think, that the biggest event that's occurred within the economy over the past several years has been inflation, which has led to elevated prices. Inflation as a recent dynamic has essentially receded, but we're still left with the legacy of that in many instances where a good number of prices remain high. So, yes, 41% of Americans say inflation is their top economic issue for the presidential election. And then I would note that the other two issues that come after that are also about affordability. Number two is health care costs, and thirdly is affordable housing. And I think perhaps underpinned by your question is essentially the thought, how much does or how much can a president do about any of that? And first of all, on inflation, a president can certainly make inflation worse. And I think there are proposals out there on both sides of the aisle right now, which could or would indeed do that, tariffs being one, sort of providing significant incentives to buy housing when housing is in short supply could be another. But if there were a lever in the Oval Office to turn inflation off, that would have already happened. Joe Biden would have pulled the switch. President Ford would have pulled the switch when he was deciding one of the best things to do to fight inflation was print up buttons that said "Whip inflation now," and that didn't work too well either.
So, may or may not be old enough to remember that, Mark. But if I was old enough, it would be pretty silly, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, well, I actually possess one of those buttons and carry it around with me.
For those that were not alive, let me just interrupt for a second. It was an interesting period because after that you had Jimmy Carter putting on a sweater, sitting in front of a fireplace, saying that the nation is in a general malaise, right? So if you think, y'all, if you think it's bad now, you have no earthly idea. Accurate?
Well, that's right. Yeah, no, for sure. And I would also say in all these cases we're talking about, the principal sources of inflation came from around the world. In the Carter case, it was OPEC. There were lines at gasoline stations for a long time, and gasoline was expensive. In this case, it was largely because of the pandemic supply shocks that both people wanted all kinds of things, many of which they couldn't get, and then the supply chains weren't producing many of those things. All those things have largely since been resolved. So I do think there's an irony that if people are trying to think about their priorities in the election, maybe there's no question that their experience with elevated prices is significant. But the question whether a president can pull a lever to make a difference there, at least to improve it, I think is highly questionable.
I represent a car dealership. Troy Duhon, he's got a family of dealerships, premier automotive dealerships. So I'm not against the car business. But I think there are a lot of people, just from you look at the luxury vehicles on the road, that might be driving, you know, $90,000 pickup trucks, $120,000 SUVs that complain about inflation. And that, to me, rings a little hollow. Am I off base here or not?
I don't think at all. You know, one of the things I found the table on with respect to trying to counsel people to achieve their financial goals is, in America, consumerism is the thing, and that's been part of the great recipe for success for our economy, along with free capital markets, capitalism, innovation, hard work, by the way, immigration that have brought so many wonderful people to this country over the centuries. But to your point, many people also want to sort of push the envelope with respect to what we can afford, and I would just simply note and you know this, that more and more people are taking out very long terms on car loans when we have elevated interest rates on car financing to begin with.
10 years on a car. That's 15 years of mortgage.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm not a fan of that. I would never do that myself. And the other part is, whether it's owning a home or owning a car, and those are, by the way, things that have been singled out in our bank rate surveys as being associated with part of the American dream, along with being able to retire from work. Many people sort of get to that destination of one of those purchases and then realize, oh my gosh, what have I done? That this experience has a total cost of ownership that I didn't anticipate, whether it's paying for insurance, paying for maintenance, paying for repair. So, hey, folks, listen up. We want to help you. It's about having a budget and not sort of getting out over our skis on affordability. And by the way, to bring it back around, here in Washington, where I work and live and have for many years, it's hard finding a spokesperson for fiscal responsibility these days, right? In other words, you know, it's between the estimates of the Harris proposals costing $3 trillion and the Trump proposals costing somewhere between $7 and $10, don't dare ask how are you going to pay for those things, because essentially you're either going to get crickets or nonsense as the answer.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I'm just curious. Do you ride the Metro or not, or do you drive?
I have. I have the benefit post-pandemic of toiling in my home. So for the most part, I'm very privileged in that regard.
Having been to Washington,
Metro is a treasure.
Sure. Having been to Washington several times, I'd never drive, man. If I was able to, if they had dependable mass transit, I'd take it here. I'll tell you that. 7:21 traffic now. WWL. 7:26 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mark Hamrick, Bankrate senior economic analyst, about voters and the economy. What did you say earlier about 3 to 7? Did you say trillion or billion?
Trillion.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
And whose plan would cost what?
It's been estimated the proposals from Vice President Harris would cost as much as $3 trillion, and that the proposals put out there by Trump, which admittedly are wide-ranging, to say the least, are somewhere costing between $7 and $10 trillion.
Do you remember, Mark, a presidential race? Because I was trying to think of this, where so much was being offered on a daily basis, so many different things on a daily basis, as far as economic policies go in the last month before an election? Because I can't, or am I just not remembering things properly? It seems like every day there's another giveaway for somebody else.
Well, I would say this is an unprecedented election cycle in most ways, and I think what you're mentioning there certainly feels that way, and that really gets to what I was saying before the break, is it's one thing to talk about essentially wanting to use the federal government to achieve certain means to provide a benefit for affordability of a home purchase, or to take away income taxes charged on tips, some of the things that have been out there. But it's another to say how you're going to pay for them. And it's very much the same as an individual who has a credit card, essentially continuing to put things on the credit card with not even giving much consideration to how much the monthly interest is going to cost. And that's where we are at the present with the federal government, where the costs of interest for the federal government are exceeding the expenditures of the Pentagon. And you know, this is not part of our daily conversation. It's not part of the conversation in the political campaign. And by the way, next month, we're going to have a survey that deals on another hot topic that's not getting any serious discussion, and that is, what are we going to do about the pending funding shortfall for Social Security when so many Americans are dependent on that? That has not seen the light of day in this campaign.
Has there ever been any research, Mark, or any way to determine how much people buying what they want instead of what they need fuels inflation, overbuying, if you will?
Not, I mean, there's so many academics out there. I could say there probably has been, but it doesn't come to mind in terms of any verifiable or confident number that I could share with you.
I just wonder if there is not a lot of this is not a self-inflicted wound, perhaps, where we see stuff on TV that we want that we don't really need, but we want it. You know, sometimes it'll be a pretty girl. It's like, man, I wish I could date her. Well, guess what? She's out of your league. You never could, never will. So. It's nice to see you. Same thing with a vehicle or a house or whatever. Thank you, Mark Hamrick. I appreciate your time as always.
Good to be with you, Tommy. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst at National Debt is looming. And now you're talking about $3 trillion in one hand, $7 trillion on the other. That's not going to cut it. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk about teens and nicotine use on WWL. 7:44, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. A delightful fall morning in the area. The average of temperatures are about 53 degrees. Not going to get to 70 until about 2 o'clock this afternoon, so get out and enjoy it while you can. Shelby McRae joins us now, specialist in pulmonary and critical care medicine at LSU Health New Orleans. I presume that's Shelby McRae, MD.
Yes, I'm a physician.
I know. I'm just kidding. How you doing, Doc?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's talk about teens and smoking and vaping and nicotine. The first thing I guess we should do is make it clear that there's really no difference between vaping and smoking as far as the body is concerned, or is one worse than the other?
You know, vaping has been around, obviously, for a lot less time than cigarettes. So some of that is still an unanswered question. I would say that there are a lot of similarities, a few differences. Of course, some of the long-term effects of vaping are still unknown because no one's been vaping for 30 years, whereas there's people who have been smoking for 30, 40, 50 years. But certainly they both can be extremely harmful, especially when started at a young age.
Doctor, I got to say this, and I went through it personally with my dad, who went and served in World War II at the age of 16, got hooked on cigarettes, died of COPD and emphysema, and he spent the last week of his life throwing up blood. And the only reason I say that, not trying to gross anybody out, but sometimes smokers say, well, something's got to kill me anyway, and they think it's going to be like a lightning bolt, and it's not. Talk about the effects of smoking on the body long term, please.
I totally agree with you, Tommy. You know, I think everyone knows, yes, lung cancer is a risk, which absolutely is a big risk factor with smoking. But smoking affects all parts of the body as well. So not just an increased risk of lung cancer, but lots of other cancers, mouth and throat cancer, bladder cancer, stomach cancer, cervical cancer. And then it can also affect, of course, heart disease. You know, the number one killer in the United States is heart disease, and that's significantly increased risk with smoking as well as strokes. But as a pulmonologist, you know, I take care of a lot of people with COPD and emphysema, and you're exactly right. It is a rough disease. People end up very thin, very frail, very short of breath, and it can be a really awful way to die. And I think it's important to realize that it's not just, oh, if I smoke, maybe I'll get lung cancer. That is real, and that is a huge issue, but there's so many other ways it affects the body as well.
And look, I'm not blaming my dad for anything at all, but not only is it hard on the patient, it is extremely hard on the family to watch you suffer like that. So if you care about your family, I suggest you quit. Doc, when it comes to nicotine and the effect on the body, this is, without doubt, an addictive drug, and these are, be it legal or not, drug dealers that are trying to get their clients hooked. Is that a misstatement or an exaggeration?
I think that that's a fair comparison. There's no benefit to it, but it makes a lot of money for people who sell it. So nicotine is extremely addictive. It very quickly is absorbed into the body. It reaches the brain within seconds of taking it, and it plays into that same reward pathway that other addictive substances like cocaine, like heroin, play into. And so targeting teens and young adults and children with these, which we all know that these companies do target, is absolutely just a way of getting teens addicted early and then continuing them as consumers who are going to provide money for years and years. And teens are looking for that reward pathway in different ways. So this is just targeting it from a way that's legalish.
So if somebody is listening right now, they're young adult, teen, whatever, maybe 35, 40, talk, if you will, about the importance of quitting whenever it is that you quit and what your body's likely to look like or react to or be. And look, there are anomalies. There are people that smoke cigarettes every day and live to be 100. There are people that, you know, get hit by lightning and survive. But that's not the mainstream. So I guess what I'm asking you, Doc, is just explain to people what they're looking forward to or not looking forward to, but what their body's likely to be like years from now if they continue to smoke or vape.
Yes, I think mentioning family support is so important, and I think it's important for parents of teens to know that you might not know if your children are doing this. It is very easy to conceal vaping. Of course, the most important thing is to prevent. So I think education is so important to prevent starting in the first place. But if people are already smoking or vaping and their families are looking for ways to support them, of course, number one is not to be judgmental. This isn't a character flaw. This is extremely addictive. It's extremely hard to quit. But to your question of how it affects the body, the longer you smoke, the more the effects of it are. And there's a lot of variation in how different people's bodies react to cigarettes. Some people, like you said, can smoke to 100 and be fine. Some people smoke for a few days and a few years and have a lot of effects. So it's hard to know exactly how your body will be affected, but the longer you smoke, the more effects there will be. That's inevitable.
Generally speaking, as a pulmonologist, I guess that's right, correct, right? Pulmonologist?
Yes.
Yeah.
Lung doctor.
Huh?
Lung doctor, if that's easier.
Lung doctor, okay. But I know because I dealt with my dad. But I just want you to talk about the effects that it has on the body and what they can look forward to, and I say that in quotation marks, feeling like in terms of lung function, et cetera, because you deal with it almost like, you know, I hate to break it down like this, like a mechanic with a car, what you're doing to your carburetor, but you can talk about what you're doing to the internal combustion engine that is your body when we come back. Shelby McCray, MD, a lung doctor, specialist in pulmonary and critical care medicine at LSU Health New Orleans. Not trying to scare you, but I know what my dad went through, and I'm trying to keep everybody healthy and happy. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWO. Quickly back to Shelby McCray, MD, a lung doctor. Doctor, I asked you a bunch of questions, but I want you to get some texts here, if I can, real quick. Somebody says, if you started smoking in your teens, you're now 60. Is it too late to try and quit, and will your body benefit from quitting now?
Absolutely. It is not too late. It's never too late. And there are tools that we as physicians can help to quit smoking. And there are absolutely benefits. If we're just thinking about the lungs, even from that standpoint, the longer you smoke, the faster you are worsening your lung function. And as soon as you stop smoking, you're not going to get back that lung function that you lost, but you're going to slow that worsening to just a normal rate. Everyone's lungs get a little bit worse as they get older, but that's accelerated and goes faster when you're a smoker. So it's not too late. And there are definitely benefits to quitting now. And the longer you stay quit, then your cancer risk goes down as well.
This is an interesting question. Please ask the doctor why orthopedic surgeons encourage patients to quit smoking before having a surgery.
Great question. So cigarette smoking especially impairs wound healing. So before any surgery, of course, if it's an emergency surgery, we have to do surgery on people whether they're smoking or not. But if it's a planned surgery or an elective surgery, you're going to have a harder time healing if you are a cigarette smoker. And so for big surgeries like orthopedic surgeries, which are usually pretty big surgeries, if you can quit smoking beforehand, then you're healing time from that surgery is going to be lower.
Doctor, you're going to have to come back because we never have enough time for this. But one thing I want to talk about, a thing out of Johns Hopkins University, because, you know, I am a very well-read guy, about these Cool Mint nicotine pouches that they're selling now. I guess it's legal. I don't know. Tell me about them. And Zyn is the name of it. Thank you, Tim Zimmer.
Yeah, I think it's different ways of kind of concealing nicotine. So these pouches are very discreet ways to have it. I think the risk there is, are we marketing nicotine as a way to quit smoking or vaping and to use nicotine as a tool to help people stop the addictive, you know, smoking, vaping, and then wear off of it? Or are we just marketing this as another way to get teens addicted to nicotine early on and then start buying other ways as well?
I would love
a slippery slope, I think.
I would love to pick it up here when we come back. Doctor, thank you. Very helpful, very informative. I'm very passionate about this after what I went through with my dad. And if I can prevent somebody else from, and you see it every day in your practice, if I can prevent somebody else from living that life or dying that death, actually, we got to do it. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Dr. Shelby McCray, a lung doctor from LSU Health New Orleans. We come back, we're talking to Mike Dettelier. Saints taking on Sean Payton and the Broncos tonight. Action here on WWL. Saints want you to black out the dome tonight. Wear black if you're going. You'll get a Drew Brees-themed rally towel. Last week, the story was the Ratla. This week, the story is the injuries, although it was last week as well. Mike Dettelier joins us now, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk, to discuss the game. How you doing, Mike?
I'm fine, Tommy. Thank you.
Mike, let me say this. And look, I know, you know, people say it happens in the NFL. Everybody's got injuries. It's no excuse or anything else. And before people start talking about regime change at the Saints and all this kind of stuff, I mean, how can you say that, and I'm looking at the injury report here. Do you think Taysom Hill's going to play tonight?
No.
I don't think he is either. I think they're just playing games by saying he's doubtful. Do you think Pete Werner's going to play tonight? He's out. No, beg your pardon. Lucas Patrick, do you think he's going to play? No. I don't think.
I would say probably not.
All right, Derek Carr is listed as doubtful. Do you think he's going to play?
No.
No, so it's the Ratla. So here's my point. And Kalen Saunders is out with a back injury. Here's what I'm trying to say, and I'm not making excuses. But you can't tell me Chris Olave out with a concussion, Rashid Shaheed, knee, out. You can't tell me that Taysom Hill is a valuable member of the Saints team and a game changer, and that you're not going to miss him, and that you can't say that that is a key injury and it is going to affect what happens. You can't say Rashid Shaheed, his absence is going to hurt. You can't say that Chris Olave being hurt is not going to hurt. Cesar Ruiz, keep going. You understand what I'm saying? This team has been hit, and I'm not making excuses, but it's only fair to say that this team has been hit hard with injuries.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The only problem with that is, in this profession, the NFL is, was that old country song, here's a quarter.
No, I understand that. Yeah, I get all of that.
Nobody, it doesn't matter, you know, to your opponent. And so you have to play with who you kind of have left on the roster. Is there been hit hard with injuries? No question. And there are other injuries that have hit other teams hard in the NFL. But, and it's part of it that everybody kind of goes through this one time or another during a season where you really kind of really hit hard with the injuries. This is, though, the big thing with me. When you set teams up in the offseason, mm-hmm. you're trying to prepare for events or an event that you're going to get hit hard with injuries. This is what you think of from February all the way through to August, how you set up your football team. And it's something I've heard coaches, GMs talk about constantly, that trying to prepare for worst-case scenario. And I think it kind of puts the emphasis on what has been a major flaw on this football team, their inability to kind of develop the young players that they have. And Deuce and I talked about this quite a bit during the offseason, that you've got a group of young players you hope can step up if called upon. Hasn't happened, Tommy. They've had opportunities and haven't been able to. And it's these type scenarios that you would see it. So it's difficult anytime you have injuries for any team to try to fight through it. And when you got a bunch of them, it makes it really difficult. But this is what you think about all off season, having events that you're not going to have certain people in, and this is who we got to call upon. And you got to develop young guys, because you're not going to have a roster full of guys that have played in the NFL. It's too costly with the salary cap world. Got to have young players step up, Tom. It just hasn't happened.
So let me ask you this. Couple of questions. First of all, when the Saints won a Super Bowl, they were relatively lucky with injuries that year, were they not?
Yes, they were. They're very lucky, and especially late, because that becomes the key, too. They had some earlier in the year, but they were able to overcome it. Late in the season, they were really lucky injury-wise. We had Dr. David Elias on, and they was talking, because I asked him yesterday about injuries, and you know, there's a number of different theories of why you see much more this year than any other year. But he said, you know, like, there is that certain element of luck.
And any team, I'm sure there might have been a team in the history of the NFL or a couple that have, you know, overcome a bunch of injuries and gone on to do well in the playoffs. But generally speaking, the teams that do well in the playoffs and make it to the Super Bowl and win have to remain relatively healthy throughout the season. Accurate?
Yeah, I know that's a Jimmy Johnson in his new book. He wrote that about he felt that wasn't the number one key, but it was the number two key of being able to stay healthy throughout a season. And he said, you know, hey, listen, you might have a season where you're not particularly lucky with injuries and you get hit around. But it's why you kind of set everything up in the offseason to try to prevent that Mount Everest drop-off in play.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.
When sometimes it happens to teams. And so it's part of the game. You have to accept it at this stage. But I think you can travel this back to, you've got some young players on this team that have not taken that step.
All right, let's talk about those players when we come back. I also want to talk about the prevalence of injuries. It seems like they got a lot more than they used to in the NFL. I don't know if it's the CBA. I don't know if it's the way it's structured. I don't know if it's drafting. I know the Saints drafted, who's the running back that can't get on the field? DeMondre Miller?
Kendra Miller.
He can't get healthy. He was hurt when we drafted him, right? Or coming off an injury. Kool-Aid McKinstry was hurt, was he not, when he played,
correct.
I understand.
He just came off a foot injury.
Right, okay. So we'll talk about all that when we come back, too. And maybe with the transfer portal and name, image, likeness, maybe college players are more prone to injury than before. I don't know. We'll pick it up with Mike Dettelier when we come back. If you got any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. But I will say it again. If you're going to the game tonight, this is when the Saints need you. They're down and out and hurting. And it's easy to jump on a bandwagon and scream and holler and shout when they're undefeated, but now's the time they really need you to back them. 821 traffic now, WWL. 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mike Dettelier, looking ahead to the Saints-Denver game tonight, to the return of Sean Payton. We're going to break down lineups when we come back in the next half hour. But, Mike, you talked about talking to Dr. David Elias about injuries and I guess, did he give some reasons as to why there might be more injuries in the NFL? Is it the CBA? Is it the lack of practice, tackling, whatever?
No, I brought it up to him about the CBA part, and he said that could be a part of it. He brought up maybe years ago, a lot of injuries were blamed on the turf, but now this new turf that they play on today, you know, it's almost like playing on grass, even when it's, you know, kind of artificial. Mm-hmm. So, man, there's a lot of different thoughts there about how the CBA, and I know they're trying to protect players, but in the long run, are you doing the right thing here? Mm-hmm. I mean, you rarely can see a padded practice. You know, most of it is in shells. It's kind of like as I've always talked about, pajamas and slippers,
right,
that you sort of walk through. I don't know how you get your body ready to play this sport without a lot of hitting going on.
How many times have you heard the phrase football shape, right? You're not in football shape?
Right. That's the difference between you being in really good shape physically and being in football shape. Your body's not used to getting hit or being in like in a three-car collision every play.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're not used to it, I think, you know, the body has certain elements to it that's going to break down.
And you know
what,
Mike?
You are starting to see it.
I think, too, it goes to reaction time and reflexes and everything else, where when you're in live action, not to be confused with the military, I know there's a big difference, but when you're actually hitting in practice, maybe your body develops some defense mechanisms, some reflexes, et cetera, so that you can protect yourself more when you're on the field during a game than you can in slippers and pajamas, right?
Yeah, and that's something, you know, Doc had brought up, that I think he said there's something to that, that element that, you know, we had talked about yesterday about that defense mechanism. And, you know, the other part about it, too, is years ago, you would go to training camp to get in shape.
Mm-hmm.
Today, you in shape to practice, okay? Because the guys are in shape. Now, every once in a while, you might have somebody coming off of an injury, or maybe they're a little bit heavier than they should. But, you know, they want you to hit the ground running. We call a play, that's what you do. It's not about practice of how to do it. And I think the other element, too, is the coaching part. And I do really do believe that. I know this sounds sort of old school, but you've got coaches that some of them say, hey, listen, they're not teaching good technique or good fundamental work. And that part of it also could lead to some injuries. But, Tommy, I am convinced that the CBA deal of them, this non-padded type practices, is leading to more and more injuries in the thought process that it would lead to less and what eventually is going to be an 18-game season.
I got
right around the corner.
I got an alternative theory I'll present when we come back, and it revolves around, believe it or not, Saints former backup quarterback Larry Sippa. Y'all can Google that if you don't remember him. 8:30, more with Mike to tell you when we come back. Time now, WWL First News. 8:44, 16 till 9. Quickly back to Mike Dettelier. Mike, Larry Sippa, quarterback for the Saints back in the day. I was a kid in high school busting tires. I worked with him at Firestone because in the offseason, these guys had to get a job, right? Well,
yep,
that ain't the case now. Now they have their own trainers. They have their own conditioning programs, offseason workouts, which brings us back to injuries and makes me think about the physics of bigger, faster, stronger. You think that plays a part in this?
There's no question about it. Again, had this conversation back in the summer. Pete Jenkins has his Louisiana line camp here, and there are probably a dozen NFL coaches that come down to work that camp. And you know, Pete would laugh because we did a remote at Nicholls State, you know, and you've got them like I get them. Football is football, guys. I just played high school ball. It's the same as no, it's not.
No.
And Pete laughed when he saw the comment. He was like, "Tell that guy, you get hit once by a 6'5", 310-pound man that can bench press 450 pounds and can run 40 yards in less than 5 seconds
and squat about 800
once.
Yeah,
and once, but he said, do it every play and see how it feels. That ain't high school football no more. And he said there is a certain part of physics that you are going to eventually break down somewhere along the line with that type hitting and that type force. And that, I think, Tommy, also has some play. If it would just be one thing, you could fix it, but it's not. And this is a brutal game. Anybody who saw the Cowboys-Lions game, and you saw Aiden Hutchinson go down with two breaks in his leg, that goes to show the brutality of this sport.
horrific.
And so you understand, if you get hit once by a guy like that is one thing. Get hit every play by somebody that size and see how it feels. So I don't know how you could get your body used to that shock if you don't do it in practice much.
Let me move on to the Broncos here. I remember talking to longtime Berman coach Emin Michelle about Patrick Surtain, the original, when he had him at Carr.
Oh, yeah.
Years ago. Now we're on Patrick Surtain 2. He's likely to play or not? No, he's out with a concussion.
He had a concussion. So like Olave, in a short week, I don't remember a guy having a concussion on a Sunday, and then he plays on a Thursday game. But, the original Patrick Surtain, man, he was some type of player. Had a double-digit career in the NFL, went to Southern Miss after he left Efton Carr, and then he's into coaching now, and then now the son. And Patrick Surtain's one of the best cover cornerbacks in the National Football League. That's a big loss for them at corner, but you sort of balance the scales, no Olave, and then the news yesterday with Rashid Shaheed.
How badly, and I'm going to get to the Sean Payton offense in a minute, but what do we do at receiver? How badly, you don't have Taysom Hill at tight end if he would or play tight end at that particular play, but what do we got at receiver? What do we got left?
You got the veteran in Cedric Wilson, Mason Tipton, the rookie from Yale, Bub Means, the draft choice from Pittsburgh. You could elevate, Kevin Austin, who's been on your practice squad, who played in the UFL, and he was former Notre Dame guy. Man, you short-sheeted at receiver this week. So that tells me Alvin Kamara is going to touch the football quite a bit tonight, and hopefully we'll get a better look. We got to get a better look because we haven't seen anything of him, of Kendra Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to have to use your tight ends if it's Foster Morrow, with Juwan Johnson. You're going to have to use those guys more. It's sort of like reminds me of that COVID game that they played on a Monday night that you had so many guys out. So you just, you got to do the best you can with what you got right now.
They had a problem with Denver years ago, too. Didn't we run out of, who was playing quarterback? Or Denver ran out of quarterbacks, right?
They ran out of quarterbacks, and they played a young man who had not played quarterback since he was a redshirt freshman in college. He was a wide receiver.
All right, let's talk about Sean Payton and his Denver Bronco offense and Bo Nix and Javonte Williams, et cetera. Adam Troutman, former Saints tight end, starting for the Broncos. It's almost like the Saints West, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah, he's collected a lot of Saints players, especially on the offensive side of the football. Little Jordan Humphrey. So A.T. Perry, he's collected them. Their offense, we had Mark Schlereff on. I said, Mark, how good is the Broncos' offense? To me, it doesn't look very good at all. And he would say, I would be kind to say they're middle of the road, but they're not even that. They are developing offense. Their offensive line has not played very well this year. They've been disappointing because Sean thought that would be the strength of the Broncos team, would be their offensive line. It has not been. They haven't been able to run the football effectively. When you're playing a young quarterback in Bo Nix, you go through the ups and downs. We saw it last week. Same thing with Spencer Rattler. You kind of go through a roller coaster with it. Watch his escapability. That is something that's underrated in Bo Nix. And Saints have had issues with quarterbacks that can run around and get up the field. And I remember Bo Nix playing LSU one time, and he made about five plays just running around and getting away from the defensive lineman. One of the defensive linemen was Mason Smith, who lives not far from where I grew up. And when I asked somebody, he said, I had him three times, dead to right, and he got away from me. That is something you're going to have to watch tonight. You're going to see a lot of Devontae Williams. He is kind of a middle-range version of Alvin Kamara as a runner receiver. That's kind of the guy, and their top receiver is Courtland Sutton. So that tells you about their offense. Their defense, front seven, very good. Excellent safety play. You're not as good at corner without Surtain. He was a tilt-the-field player, and he took away one side. So you got to attack that area where Surtain would have been. But their defense has really saved their bacon, really has. Their front seven is young, aggressive, and fast at a football.
How about their defense without Patrick Surtain? I know, but
the front seven is good, and the safety play has been good despite losing Justin Simmons. Man, I'd attack their corners. Just because you don't have your best defensive player out there tonight. Can the Saints do that, though, with the receiving core that they have? So you're going to have to roll Rattler out and kind of cut the field off of him, designated throws. That's what he was effective last week with in the second quarter against the Broncos. Tampa. What Tampa did was shoot people, kind of overload the front and try to get pressure on him. If you could run the football, you run the football on fronts like that, because all they worried about doing is getting in the backfield to try to make a sack. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you can't run the ball, you got some difficulties. That's going to be the key for the Saints tonight. They have to give Rattler kind of a running game to at least take all that pressure off of him.
Vance Joseph, the defensive coordinator, former Shaw player,
yep.
So another West Bank connection. One thing I'm concerned with tonight is Sean Payton and his trickeration on offense. What do you think?
Well, he tricks you because he knows he doesn't have the talent that could beat you play in, play out. So he was like that with the Saints at times. He liked a lot of these trick plays and try to hit a big play off of it. In a short week, how much of that you're able to put in remains to be seen. And the kid quarterback, I mean, both of them are going to make mistakes. Nix is going to make it. Rattler's going to make it. Who doesn't make the mistakes? I think that's the other part of it, because Bo has a tendency. He thinks he can put a football anywhere out on the field. And him and Sean have jawed about it. I mean, you've seen the cuts of him and Peyton on the sidelines, going at it a little bit, and I get it. And I'll be honest, I think Coach Peyton likes that. He likes the quarterback that's going to talk back to him and tell him, this is what I saw, this is what you said, but this is what I saw out on the field.
You know,
so you got to stay away from the turnovers, and you got to get them.
What amazes me is, like, you see Garrett Nussmeier and Brian Kelly be talking to him, and a quarterback just walks away. I can't imagine doing that with a head coach, but I guess it happens, huh, Mike?
Yeah, Joe Burrow was like that with Coach O. That's a much longer story for another day. But Joe would kind of, okay, yeah, I heard it before.
Yeah. Garrett Nussmeier does that with Coach Kelly, same thing.
Yeah, and that drove Coach O up the wall. That Burrow wouldn't talk back to him at times.
Man, you got some stones if you turn your back on a head coach while he's talking to you and walk away. That's all I got to say. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you later. All right, we'll take a break. 8:55 traffic now, WWL. And down the stretch we come. We're going to talk to JR later on, just in time for the Saints game and all the college games, get you some weekend winners, JR, with Taking Vegas. But first, we're joined by our friend Ghassan Korban, Executive Director of the New Orleans Surge and Water Board. How you doing, Ghassan?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Tommy.
You know, I'm a fan of yours. I want you to succeed because I'm surprised, and I've said this before, I'll say it again, that you're still here. I thought sure they would have run you off by now, but they haven't, and I'm proud of you for that. You gotta feel better on a day like today, right? Because you are dealing with a system that's antiquated, that's fragile, and when the skies are blue and the sun is shining, you get to focus on other things, right?
Absolutely. We can focus on the future and obviously contemplating our vision and executing on it. So today is a good day for us.
On a personal note, do you miss the cold weather in Milwaukee or not?
Not at all.
No? You like this? Huh? This is good for you?
Oh, this is like perfect weather. I could take this any day of the week.
Before we get to lead pipe removal, let's talk about smart meters. How are they working out? What's going on with them?
We're doing well. We're tracking. We're keeping up with the pace, and we are slated to finish 50% of the entire population by the end of this year. That's about 70,000 of those, which means we would be producing 70,000 smart bills, which is exactly what obviously our customer want and need. And obviously, we're looking at next year and how we can either maintain or expedite the rate of installation so we can either obviously finish the rest by the end of next year or sooner. So in the meantime, we're also, you know, doing a couple other things to make our customers' lives obviously easier by providing a flat rate bill. We're launching that this week. So we're doing it in tranches. So anybody who does not have a smart meter will receive from us an offer, basically, of a customized flat rate for their household, for their account. And they then have the ability to opt in if they like the number. And then we would put them on that flat rate with no true-up at the end. And as soon as we get the smart meter for their house installed, we stop the flat rate and we start charging based on the accurate consumption that we're registering.
So with the flat rate, is that meter being read or not, Ghassan?
We would read it just for sake of keeping track of our consumption, production and consumption. So because we're obligated also to track all the leakage and all the non-revenue water. So we do it for that purpose only.
So do you
once you opt in, you're locked into that number, regardless of your consumption. And again, you can enjoy it until you get the smart meter installed.
How do you arrive at what that flat rate is?
So we look at the historic consumption, including estimates as well as actual reads, and we've devised a formula that we've ran through a lot of. A variety of those, and we arrived at what we think is the most fair number. And so we've done calculations for about 70,000 or more of those accounts. And again, at the end of the day, you will have to agree to that number. That number has to look reasonable to you before you opt in. And once you opt in, you know, you're good with that consistent number for the duration until the smart meter for your house is installed.
Is the reason for that because you don't have enough people to read meters, or is it about leakage and what's contested or whose responsibility what is, Ghassan?
There's so many variations that just impact the inconsistency. One, in our inability to read in consistent basis and read accurately. So, you know, we're relying on our folks to go out, consistently touch every meter once a month and read it accurately, enter that data accurately. And there's just a lot of room for error. So then if we miss a read, then you have to estimate, and sometimes the estimates are accurate, sometimes they're not. So it's that up and down and the fluctuation that, you know, drive our customers, you know, crazy, to be honest with you. And it's just not a good place. But then you also add any leaking on the private side that could spike consumption, throws everybody off. Sometimes it's evident, sometimes it's not. And then, you know, you just have to manage that. So now with the flat rate, we know we're actually taking on some of that, the loss of water or, you know, basically wasted water. But it's a price to pay to just keep, you know, make our customers' lives a little bit, you know, easier until we install the more permanent solution, which is the smart meters.
What has the reaction been from customers with the smart? First of all, Ghassan, maybe we take things for granted. I live in Blackmans. I have a smart meter. I know how it works. But for people that don't know, we're throwing this term around. Explain what that is, please.
So basically, it's a picture a cell phone on top of your meter that registers your consumption accurately on a constant basis and emitting those reads on constant basis, and then we receive those numbers, and then, you know, basically store them, and we can track the consumption. We can look for any anomalies, for any spikes, for anything unusual. But we also are able to, and because it's consistent reads and then timely, we can define a period of 30 days, and then every 30 days we would process a bill for you. So that brings a consistency, it brings the accuracy, it brings the timeliness. So it's just it's a simple device that captures consumption and sends it to us, and then that takes out all the room or opportunities for error, and, you know, weather is not an issue. So it's just, you know, it's so totally a very effective and efficient way to capture consumption accurately and bill our customers accordingly.
And also, this will tell you exactly what, I guess maybe the other meter worked this way as well, but if there's a leak on the other side of the meter with the smart meter, maybe it works with the other meter as well, that's got to be the property owner, not the sewage and water board, right? Or not?
Absolutely. And the difference here is, yeah, we would have known that there's a leak with the old meters. It's the real-time information that we are receiving now with the smart meters. And within about a week, from now, you'll be able to access a portal or, you know, basically a customer portal where you are able to track your own consumption and even introduce parameters or boundaries for your consumption. So, you know, like you want to use 100 gallons a day, no more, and it will tell you if you exceed that, so you can adjust. It will tell you if there's a sudden spike in your consumption that you're not aware of. It could be an open flap, a toilet of a bathroom that you don't use often, and that would alert you instantly, and then you can just, you know, take care of that almost immediately and then avoid any unnecessary costs. So it's definitely a, you know, a huge, huge game changer for us and the customers in terms of the quality and just, again, removing that doubt that comes with our bills and has ailed us for several years.
How's everything working on the office side of
this is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.
That of the smart meters with the whatever computers you need to process all of this stuff, the people you need to process the smart meters of the almost, I guess, 70,000 you said you have installed? Not yet, right?
Yeah, we will have 70 by the end of this year. So we have what we call a strike team, a special team that's designated just for smart meter processing. We're making sure that every process had been studied, had been debugged, so to speak, and then, you know, we're bringing all the right people, put the right people in the right seats to make sure that it's smooth. So it's been really, I mean, minor infractions here and there, but overall, everybody has played their role well. And again, we're producing very accurate bills. And, you know, it's predicated on the fact that we took our time preparing and planned and interfaced all the software that we needed to interface very, very systematically and intentionally. So it's going well.
This might be a dumb question, but what powers those smart meters?
There's batteries in them, and there is a 20-year life on those batteries guaranteed. So obviously, in 20 years or less, we're going to have to go out there and replace those. But, I mean, obviously, we have time. So our focus on it's a proven products. Other cities have used them. We are going to train a team of technicians to make sure we stay ahead on, you know, maintaining those meters, making sure that they are in working order. So our meter readers, part of that team will be trained, will be elevated in terms of skill sets and obviously positions and compensation. So they'll be the team that will make sure that that system is sustainable and efficient and working well for our customers.
And I guess it'll be like a capital project. 17 years from now, you start changing them out with the ones. You don't wait till they fail like a car battery, kind of like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We know that obviously, you know, ideally we would have done maybe 20% every year so we can stagger them. Mm-hmm. But we are so eager to get those smart meters in the ground. I mean, we're so far behind in terms of, you know, delivering this project should have been in the ground 15 years ago, quite honestly. So we know we're rushing the installation, and we are going to start sooner. Obviously, like you said, in the 17th year, we're going to preemptively start replacing, you know, maybe a third at a time to stay ahead and make sure that there, you know, there's no gaps in the service.
Well, let's hope you and I are both around to see it, Ghassan. We'll take a break, pick it up, we come back, talk about lead pipes. And also, I think a good jumping off point would be drawing a line, and maybe we'll do a little radio diagram about who's responsible for what at what point, especially when it comes to replacing lead pipes. We're talking to Ghassan Qurban, Executive Director, New Orleans Sewerage and Water Board. I'm glad he's here. I think he's doing a great job, and I'm surprised that they haven't run him off, as I often say, but I'm glad they haven't. We all know who they are. 921 traffic now. No traffic. We'll just take a break on WWL. You don't often see a guy false start on the same play twice. Imagine, if you will, a horizontal line, and let's draw a vertical line, okay? And on one side of that vertical line, you got your house and you got your yard and you got the point of entry into the house of the water. Then you got a pipe heading to the water meter to the property line. Then from that point, you have the pipe heading out to the sewer. Ghassan Qurban, Executive Director of the Sewerage and Water Board. I do that okay? Pretty well?
Well, yes, except for you refer to the water main as a sewer. It's actually a water main bringing drinking water to your house.
Oh, wait, so, I forgot about that. Yeah, you got a supply too, don't you?
Right, so we have two lines. One is, we call it the lateral, sewer lateral, that takes wastewater away from your house into a sewer main and away into toward the wastewater treatment plant.
How could I screw that up?
Water.
Let me start all over.
I don't know.
let's start all over. So imagine a horizontal and a vertical line with the water coming into your house. Draw a horizontal line, your house on one, and then draw a vertical line. House on one side, the property line is where the vertical line is drawn. The water meter goes up to that property line, then the rest of the water goes into your house into the point of entry. From on the other side is the water main that feeds the water to the water meter. Thank you. I was talking about the drainage side. I got confused. With that being said,
perfectly done.
Let's talk. Thank you. I can't believe I did that. Let's talk about. I'm not a plumber though, Ghassan. Thank God for that. Let's talk about the prevalence of lead pipes. How much of a danger that is in the city, and how you plan on going about mitigating that and splitting the cost of it.
Right. So we're at a point now where we have a full inventory that was produced through a machine learning. So we have a model that predicts basically where we know for certain there's lead lines. And that line we're referring to is from the water main to the point of entry. So we're not distinguishing at this point whether it's on the private side or the public side, because our intention is to remove and replace both. Okay. So now we have a model that tells us for certain which ones are lead and which ones are not lead. And in between, there's a large population where we do not know whether it is lead or not. So it is uncertain or unknown. And by law, we treat those as if they are lead, obviously for the obvious reason that we have to assume the worst until proven otherwise. Mm-hmm. So now where we are today, we have an inventory of that. You can go on our website and click on enter your house address, and we'll tell you what material your service line is made out of, whether it's we are then delineating between the private portion versus the public portion. We can tell you what either one is, They're both led. If one is not, you'll know that. Now, with that, what that does for us, it sets in motion a plan for us to start prioritizing. We have secured funding, as you may know, from the EPA, that money that came from the bipartisan infrastructure law that's been allocated to the states across the nation. And in our case, we had $86 million given to the state and through the state revolving fund and the Louisiana Department of Health, which is the regulatory agency for us, have allotted the $86 million for us specifically to launch this effort of removing and replacing lead lines from the city. EPA wants us to use the money to do both. So we are now launching the effort, going to property owners and basically explaining the exposure to lead and what it means to them and their families, and offering to do the work on their behalf at no cost to them. This is a great opportunity for people to take advantage of this, basically, let's call it an offer or an opportunity, because if that money, say, runs out, eventually the EPA at the federal level and ultimately at the state level is going to mandate those lines to be removed. And the private portion of the line from between the meter and the point of entry is the responsibility of the property owner. So should the money dry out and we're not offering what we're offering today, then it is on the property owner's responsibility to remove and replace at their own expense. So this is a great time. We're taking advantage of a mandate that is funded and allowing us to do it right and do it in totality, meaning replacing both sides of the lines and removing the exposure of lead once and for all.
So I'm looking at the website right now, and I put the house, the address of my old house in Algiers in it, on Plymouth Place, and I'm looking at the house I was in has a red dot, which means unknown public side assumed lead. The house next to it is unknown, and then the house next to that has unknown public side assumed lead. Why would that be? Why would it not be the whole neighborhood?
So because we took individual records and fed a program, so we took plumbing and permits, whatever records we have in terms of we were, let's say we were at your house at one point digging up some, you know, for some work that we're doing, and put eyes on the actual line and documented that. So any data we had available to us, we input it in that program. And that's how the program was able to, through analytics, put together, you know, the data that you have. So if it says it's lead, we know it's lead.
It says utility side non-lead, as I get the non-lead window that pops up, but customer side right. Lead.
Yes. So that means we, at one point, were at that site, and we removed and replaced our portion. Due to current policies, or maybe we needed to replace it because it was leaking, and then walked away, because that's the law that you could. That's fully compliant. Mm-hmm. Now moving forward, if I'm at that place and I'm removing mine, I'm gonna knock on your door and say, "Would you please let me on your property and let me replace yours, because yours is also lead."
Now you're
versus
talking about
what we may have done in the past.
The surge in water board or a plumber?
Well, we will be hiring plumbers / contractors. You know, we're going to have a large scale replacement program throughout the city with prioritization. And so we will ask you to sign a form like right of entry, allowing us to go on your property for a couple hours and allow us to remove and replace your line, connect it at the point of entry, run it to the new meter, to the meter, and then have the entire line becoming non-lead.
And who's paying for that, Ghassan?
Well, through the grant and the loans we're getting from the EPA, they're encouraging us and to use their money to do the private portions as well. So we are paying for it at this point. As long as this money is available, we're going to offer that arrangement. We let us do it at our own expense, at no cost to you, and let's get the entire line removed in its entirety. Again, this offer may not exist forever because we don't know if the funding is going to be sustainable, is going to continue coming at the same level. At one point, we may be forced to just spend the funds on the public portion and then mandate that the private property assume the cost and meeting the requirements of, you know, replacing their lines on their own, which is not, obviously it's done for in the interest of this public safety, but, you know, again, the cost may be on them at that point. So, but we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Today, we're offering that, you know, allow us on your property and we'll replace your lead line at our own expense.
This is a big deal that I think people need to pay attention to, because we all know that the seriousness of, and if you want to address that quickly, Ghassan, about the dangers associated with lead pipes.
Well, it's been known fact for years. I mean, lead pipes have been used for 100 years. It was allowed to be used in the city as early or as late as 86, maybe even 87. So it's prevalent. It's everywhere. Lead can cause, serious issues in terms of the word is escaping me, but I mean, the most vulnerable population is the children under six. So that's obviously, those are our top priorities. That's why our first phase of our project is to replace all lead lines at schools and daycares. The word I was looking for before is cognitive ability. So it could impede or adversely impact the cognitive abilities of children. So it's obviously very serious, among other dangers. So, I know the city has been aware of this issue, but we just haven't really put this issue front and center until now. So we're very eager to start and, you know, be as efficient as we can and remove that danger out.
What is the median cost? Do you have any idea of replacing it on the homeowner's side? And what people are being able to take advantage of, I guess, is what I'm talking about. If they don't take advantage of this now, Ghassan, and they have to do it themselves, what they could be looking at?
It could be a couple thousand dollars. I mean, the cost may be in the restoration. So on our side is definitely more expensive because we have to restore pavement, curbs, sidewalks. If it's the rest of it, you know, on the private property is grass, you know, basically it's a shallow utility, maybe 3 feet deep. Mm-hmm. So maybe a couple of grand, but, you know, it's a couple of grand that we will absorb and we will do it. We're going to try to implement the least destructive or intrusive technology, meaning we're going to try to pull the lines through rather than excavating if we can. Especially if the lines that currently exist are 18 inches or deeper, because that's the law. So we will use the existing pipe to tie it to the new line and use that to pull the new line and use the same cavity of the existing pipe and then just pull the lead out completely. And by doing so, you know, there's a new pipe in its place. So we'll have maybe two smaller holes on your property that we'll obviously restore to the same condition as we found it. And then, you know, within less than a day.
Two quick questions, Ghassan, before we run out of time. Is there an area of the city or areas of the city that are more concerned than others?
Well, the older the city, the houses, the more likely you're going to have lead. you know, the EPA, because of, you know, the money is coming from them, they're obviously provided us with the criteria that we need to follow in terms of disadvantaged communities, people who cannot afford doing their own lines. We're going to give those priorities. Houses that we know for a fact the levels of lead are higher than others, we're going to obviously prioritize those. If you have yours done, so your private portion is not lead, we're going to obviously come and do ours to make sure that ours is not lead. So there's a criteria we're going to follow. And, you know, this is a 10 to 13 year plan, assuming we're going to have a steady, you know, flow of money.
Do they contact you or do you contact them?
We're going to be reaching out through multiple means, letters, postcards. We're going to be knocking on people's doors. So everybody in the city will know that this effort is ongoing. We need your participation. And we're going to have, obviously, phone numbers for them to call and sign up. They will not be missed. So if you're a property owner who's interested, you will get the attention you need.
Thank you, Ghassan. And y'all can go to swbno.org/project/lead awareness map, and you can do what I did with the old house I owned in Algiers. Thank you, Ghassan. I appreciate your time and your efforts.
Thank you so much, Tom.
You bet. Executive
Bye-bye.
Director, New Orleans Sewerage and Water Board, thousands of dollars to mitigate lead pipes. If there's a grant to do it, I would take advantage of it. 9:42, 18 till 10. We'll talk to JR with Taking Vegas when we come back. Saints playing tonight against Denver. Also talk about some college football right now, though. Traffic, WWL. All right, here we go. The man, the myth, the legend, JR with Taking Vegas. You hear his show every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. How you doing, JR?
I'm doing unbelievably good, Tommy. I could not be more excited to be on air with you this fine Thursday. And I got news for you guys. This is going to be an exciting game tonight with the Broncos coming into town to take on your beloved Saints.
Damn right. It's going to be exciting. Go ahead, JR.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm pumped up. I really am. Yeah. When you do what I do for a living, there are certain games that just plain stand out, mm-hmm. and this is definitely one of those games. I really, not just giving it out because it's happening tonight, I love the game. I mean, when it comes down to what I'm looking at as an expert in this business, I don't like this game. It's one of those games I absolutely love. So here's what I'm doing. All you got to do, text the word WIN to 545454, and you get the winner of this Thursday night matchup between the Broncos and Saints absolutely free via text message. And bonus game, guys, you're also going to get the winner of the LSU-Arkansas game, Battle of the Boot. That, too, is going to be free when you text the word WIN to 545454. Couldn't make this easier for you. All you got to do is send a word to 545454, text the word WIN, and you get this winner absolutely free. And again, my games are not just who's going to win. It's not a survivor pool. These are against the spread, and it's absolutely free. Give it a ring, or excuse me, give it a text. Just text WIN to 545454.
Give it a ring. You getting engaged, JR? Love's in the air or what? What's going on?
I'm so used to telling the people call the free pick hotline that, I mean, not for nothing, the legalization of sports betting has made us boom in business. I mean, obviously it's great, but, you know, technology is a wonderful thing, so we try to figure out ways to make sure that we can get this to the masses, and text messaging has definitely been taking over and has made things a whole lot easier on us to be able to get that info to even more people.
But like any tool, if you don't know how to use it, you can hurt yourself. For example, you know, everybody's all excited, Chiefs 5-0, Vikings 5-0. First of all, it doesn't have to be a big game to make money off of it. Secondly, before you put money on it, it's best to know what the hell you're doing, and that's where your service comes in.
No question about it, and I appreciate you even bringing that up. Guys, right now, the general public, unfortunately, has been getting absolutely smashed throughout this season. Since they've been keeping records because of the legalization of sports betting of, you know, how good or bad the public is doing versus the books, this is by far, not even close, the worst year on record. And it is literally upside down like I've never seen it. I mean, if you want to try to take this on your own, you don't realize what a difficult task that it is, especially now you've got media out there. I'm not going to mention names, but you got to understand, some of the media actually have interests because they own sports books. So what are they going to do? They're going to feed you information to try to beat themselves? Or are they going to try to put it into your head to take the wrong sides of these games, and you get pre-programmed, unfortunately, watching all of it, that you fall into the trap and you wind up going with all the information that's being fed to you? So we are the experts, okay? We're not watching these channels to see what the media is saying. We're looking at the facts.
JR, real quick.
We're looking at what we think is going to be the outcomes of these games. We find the mistakes. We look for the edge. Got to remember, lines are not being made based on the actual outcomes of these games. It is on the public perception of what they think the public believes is going to happen, so they can get 50% of the money on one side and 50% on the other side. They're looking to just clean up and get that juice money or that vig that they're going to be laying in order for guys to be taking both sides of the game, right? So they have one challenge, and that is to be able to clean up by getting more action on both sides of the game. That's where we look at it with you know, expert eyes, knowing the matchups, knowing what the line should be, finding what we call a mistake or the right situation and pouncing on it. And I could tell you, tonight is definitely one of those nights. And I, again, I'm going to repeat it. I don't like it. When I say this, guys, I truly do. I love this game tonight. And you got to just text the word win to 545454 right now to get the winner of the Broncos-Saints game free of charge via text message and a bonus game, Battle of the Boot, the one I know you guys want. That's the winner of Arkansas-LSU. All you got to do is text the word win to 545454, and you get them for free.
JR, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but settle a fight between Tim and I that we're having. Bookmaking 101. If I can put out false information out there that gets you to bet on the wrong team without changing the odds to influence you to do that, that's gravy for the bookmaker, is it not?
Of course it is. I mean, listen, again, I'm not naming names, but there are plenty of media outlets out there that all have interests and own, in some cases, sports books. And what are you doing all day? You're listening to that channel because that's the only thing out there pumping into your brain what you want to hear, and that is everything football, and especially now with the baseball playoffs. We got college and pro basketball that are about to start. NHL is going on. I mean, most guys are not looking to listen to any more political nonsense. They want to get on there and hear about their teams.
JR, real quick, you are 7-0 in the free Lagniappe picks that you give us every day. You are on fire. What do you got for us today?
Unfortunately, with this one, guys, I'm going to have you up early on Sunday morning. This one's going to be the England game. Jacksonville has been over there since last week. They've been getting beat up all, you know, let's face it, this whole season they've looked absolutely terrible. Lawrence just not playing the way that he should be with the money that he's getting paid. Everyone blaming the head coach. Peterson's job has been on the hot seat for weeks now. But yet they're taking on the Patriots. And I think that with Jacksonville already being out there, that is already a huge advantage. And this Patriots team is, I don't want to say they're in disarray because they're building right now, right? You're going to have a rookie quarterback out there. You've got a rookie head coach in a very, you know, what is going to be neutral to hostile environment. There are more fans for Jacksonville out there because of the base that they've built over the years than there will be for New England. So I don't really like this one. I do really, really love this one. Get in Jacksonville. That line, public thinks it's too high. They are betting the Patriots, but guys, this is an easy one. Jaguars absolutely smoked the Patriots this week. Don't be afraid to lay the 5.5. But again, one more time, let's get this winner in tonight. Love this matchup between the Broncos and Saints. Text the word win to 545454 to get it for free. Plus the winner of the big matchup, college football. Guys, I'm telling you now, I've got this one locked up. I gave you LSU last week. I'll let you know whether or not they're going to win the Battle of the Boot against Arkansas this week. Just text that word, win, to 545454.
Thank you, Jerry. You don't have to get up early. Just make your bet and cash in, and when you wake up. Thank you, sir.
You got it. Always a pleasure. Guys, go out there and make some money.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC's senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.